Welcome to Sacrilegious Discourse.
For this is what the Sovereign Lord says.
Why do you need prophets to tell people who you are and what you want?
If you can justify everything that the God of the Bible has done, then you can justify any of your behavior.
A lot of this mentality is trickling into what is now mainstream right-wing Christianity.
I am capable of empathy greater than this God of the Bible.
This is a Bible that they tell kids. This is the good Lord. This is the good book. He is fantasizing about murder, mass murder.
Head over to sacrilegiousdiscourse.com right now to find out how to leave us a review or support us on Patreon.
Husband!
Wife!
Do you know what we're still doing today?
Well, we started a Q&A yesterday for Matthew chapters 5 through 7, but it ran a bit long.
It did. We're trying to cover the Sermon on the Mount, which is, as you said, Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah.
And chapter 5 was a lot.
Yeah, so it was basically just a Q&A over chapter 5 yesterday.
Well, and the sermon itself.
Sure, we covered some
sermon-y Jesus
things.
Right,
but it got up to an hour, and we're like, you know, that we probably shouldn't make this like a 3-hour episode. So.
Yeah, 6 and 7 can suck it. They get their own show. So that's what we're doing today. We're finishing the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 6 and 7 of Little Maddie.
All right, more Jesus. Yay!
I know, I love that for us.
Well, whatever. I mean, it's kind of what we do, right?
Yeah. I do love that for us.
I mean, in a way. In a weird atheist way.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So that's we're doing Matthew chapter 6 and 7 Q&A. And are you ready to get into this?
Sure as fuck am.
Let's do it.
Okie dokie. All right. So continuing the Sermon on the Mount.
Okay.
We have a little bit of a change. It's kind of good that we stopped where we did at the end of chapter 5.
Sure.
Because we have a little bit of change in style.
Okay.
Chapter 5 focused a lot on ethics and reinterpretations of the law. Like, there was a lot of, you have heard it said.
Right.
And then I would go back and look up, where was it said?
Well, and I remember you said in the last episode that this was, like, Matthew or whoever wrote fucking Matthew took different sayings and bunched them all together into one speech.
Yeah.
So the reason we got style changes in the first place is probably because this isn't actually one speech that actually happened.
It was a bunch of different ones.
Right.
Stuck all together.
Sure.
As usual, they stapled things in place. And so, yeah, chapter 5 was a lot of me pulling from the first 5 books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch.
Right.
You know, where it was originally scripted.
Yeah.
And chapter 6, it shifts a little bit more towards motivation and inner sincerity, which isn't necessarily far off from what he was talking about anyway.
Right.
A recurring theme in the Sermon on the Mount as a whole is, are you doing this for God or for the gram?
Right.
For applause.
But I'm assuming there's not as much prophecy stuffing going on in this section, in these sections, I guess.
It's just more like, hey, so here's what I want you to do.
Right.
And less, remember when God said this?
Yeah.
It's more just, okay, so here's what we're going to do.
Okay.
All right. A huge amount of chapter 6 is a criticism of conspicuous morality, religious branding, public virtue displays, and wealth obsession.
Mm, I did love these.
Yeah. Yeah. We had...
things to say.
We had things to say about how current day
comments
Christians...
Comments to make.
Yeah,
yeah.
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 A word that Jesus uses repeatedly throughout chapter 6 is the word hypocrite. And that comes from Hippocrates. That's the Greek.
Got it.
Which originally meant stage actor or someone performing a role.
Okay.
That's where the word hypocrite comes from.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when Jesus is attacking hypocrites, he's often accusing people of performing righteousness theatrically, which connects strongly to social media morality, influencer spirituality, public philanthropy, image curation, and virtue signaling.
This wasn't lost over the last 2,000 years on me.
No.
I very much enjoyed the calling out of mm-hmm. the performative religious whatever.
And that Jesus is saying, you know, stop posing for the gram, stop being performative.
Yeah.
That's what this whole chapter in particular, the Sermon on the Mount in general, but chapter 6 in particular focuses on stop posing for the gram.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Stop posing for the gram being a reference to Instagram, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm, sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm having you spell it out because I had never heard that term until just now.
Are you serious?
I got it through context, but I've never heard that.
Oh, so, okay. I did
and
it for the
you
gram.
Tend to just take
pop culture
things, and just run with it like everybody knows it.
Because I'm 50, and I assume if I know a pop culture reference, everybody knows it. And I've been told repeatedly that I should not assume that, and that just because somebody else doesn't know it, that doesn't make them stupid, bad, or wrong.
I think you know more pop culture references than most kids these days.
I would argue that. Okay. Because there are so many things that we have a 21-year-old and they will come and explain something to me that I've never heard of. And I'm always disappointed, like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Because I want to be that 50-year-old that knows all of
that. The difference between you and me is that you run and do research on that new thing. And I don't give a shit.
It's not just that, though. I mean, earlier today I made a pop culture reference that was from the 80s. So you get neither the ones from our childhood.
I didn't care in the 80s and I don't care now.
Right. So I don't know where I was going with that other than I'm cool and you are a fuddy-duddy.
Sure.
I'm in my head.
I'm fine with that.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool. So in chapter 6 starts out with Jesus doing teachings on almsgiving, giving alms to the poor.
Yeah.
Alms for the poor, right. Alms. He warns against doing this kind of thing just to be seen by others.
Yeah.
And he also gives some examples of the wrong kind of giving versus the right kind of giving.
Sure.
Okay. He says, be so unconcerned with praise that even you aren't obsessing over how virtuous you are.
Sure. So, I mean, that if you're going to give because it's the right thing to do and you want to do it.
Of course.
Right?
Of course.
To me, that's the only way you should give. For example, you and I don't really have extra money to throw around.
No, we really don't.
But we talk all the time about places that we would want to invest our money, like as far as donations, right?
Sure.
And they're not because we want some sort of reciprocation or anything like that.
No, just things we would love to support.
We want to support these things, mm-hmm. right? We want to help them. We want to do more to help this world and do better in it, you know?
Whether it's small independent artists versus large well-known artists versus things like PBS and NPR versus
Freedom From Religion Foundation, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, across the board, just different people and organizations, whether it's in the arts or atheism or do good kinds of things.
No, and this is why we would never be super, you know, Elon Musk rich, because we would just give our fucking money away.
No, it's
and
so
I'm
true.
Fine with that.
No,
I
it's
think
so
that
true.
Is the way to be. You know,
you're not
like
supposed
why
to
would
hoard
you,
your wealth?
But I don't do this because of Jesus.
No,
right. I do it because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
Because it's the thing that would make a difference in this world to help other human beings be better in their lives. And to me, what is this world if we're not helping each other?
Okay, this sounds so fucking cheesy, but when we had more money when the kids were little, one of my favorite things was Christmas time, and we had money to buy for like friends and family and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I love buying gifts for people, not because it reflects back on me, but because I find so much pleasure in seeing something and saying, so-and-so would love that. That is the perfect thing for them. They would so enjoy this. And just knowing what somebody else would want or need or enjoy, that gives me happiness. Well, and that's why I would do it.
Yeah. And I've talked about this on way back, probably on another podcast episode. I know I've mentioned it before, but one of my favorite Christmases ever was one where our entire family decided
when you were a kid,
when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Our entire family, instead of buying presents for each other, everybody decided to craft or build or make a gift for everybody. So it was everything that was given or got that Christmas at our family get together was something that somebody else made. And it was really cool. So cool.
That's really cool. I love that idea.
Yeah.
I just think it's fun to give people things, and I love supporting organizations, and I love giving. I love giving.
Yeah.
And I think everybody should love giving.
I agree.
Public benefactors in the ancient Mediterranean world often wanted recognition. I talked a lot about this in the previous chapter, that they would make a big show out of the doing good and versus the being punished. They made a big spectacle out of punishing and retribution. They wanted recognition for donations, particularly because they could buy honor, social status, political influence, and religious prestige. And a lot of that hasn't changed
over time. Yeah, I mean, so, I think that's very much still the way a lot of things work. Mm-hmm. You buy your way in through donations, through
giving. I mean, I know our president here in America recognizes anybody with money as a worthy individual.
At least for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So Jesus, in his sermons, he's pushing back against that system. He's like being really, like almost just revolting against.
Yeah.
You know, he's like striking up a rebellion. And me and you had kind of talked about this, particularly in chapter 6, that I was like, well, no, he's preaching to the rich, telling them to get up off their money. And you said, no, but what if he's actually preaching like to the poor and telling them, you know, about oppression? And you were like, what if it's like the Fox News of today telling the poor or telling the rich, you're fine, ignore the gas prices, and telling the poor, you can totally afford everything. Don't believe your lying eyes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was pushing back on that. It turns out I was wrong. You knew Jesus. Jesus was being that rebel, that liar, but for good.
Yeah.
So you were closer to the truth of it.
Nice.
Yes. Yeah. This chapter is totally critiquing virtue signaling.
Right.
And we're going to get into some examples of that.
Okay.
So, we're going to start with the Lord's Prayer, and I'm just going to reread it here just for reference of what the fuck we're talking about, how it is in our interpretation or in our translation, and that matters because different translations have it a little bit different.
Right, right.
Okay. Ours is in verses 9 through 13. This then is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. I'm sorry, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. And then a lot of other translations, ours didn't, but a lot of other translations will add, for yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.
That was part of the one I learned.
And that was part of the song that I learned. No, Father. Yeah, I won't do the whole thing, but yeah, just as a reminder, go back and listen to that episode. It was it was peaches.
Yeah, good stuff.
So good.
Good stuff.
So I wanted to do a little thing on daily bread, because that is something that there's a daily devotional called the Daily Bread.
Okay.
And I'm not certain that everybody that is a secular or atheist audience might know, but a devotional is this thing where every day you're sent a different verse from the Bible, random. And it's a verse from the Bible, and then it's a little interpretation of it and how you should apply it in your life today, and here's a prayer you should pray about it.
Yeah.
And it might either be like you're on an email list or a subscription, or there's a little pamphlet that's called The Daily Bread.
Okay.
And so that's where they got that from. That's where the title comes from, Daily Bread. Give us this day our daily bread.
The
title of the daily devotional is Daily Bread.
No, I thought you were saying the Bible got it from that. And I'm like, wait, that doesn't work out.
No.
Timeline-wise.
No, you had it backwards.
In any way whatsoever. Yeah.
You had that backwards.
Yeah.
But I was like, so what is daily bread? What does that mean that somebody would find it so, like, give us this daily bread in here, and then somebody else would be like, that is so spiritual. Let's make a daily devotional about it.
Okay.
Right? Daily bread is linguistically mysterious, actually, because the Greek word for daily is super bizarre and extremely rare, as it appears in that particular verse.
Okay.
That word that's used there barely appears anywhere else in any surviving Greek literature as a whole.
Wow.
Its use in the Bible is like, huh?
Huh.
Yeah. So scholars debate whether it actually means daily, necessary, sufficient, for the coming day, supernatural, future bread. I really like that one. Supernatural, future bread.
So there's a question about the daily bread.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Some ancient translators, as they were taking it from the Greek,
yeah,
they were already confused by that term. That's how...
Wow.
Not often...
Yeah.
How rare it was in use already.
Got it. So that line alone
mm-hmm.
could be interpreted multiple ways.
I mean, yes and no. Like, the list that I gave you, daily, necessary, sufficient, they're all kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic message probably stays similar.
The message doesn't change. I just find it interesting because this means that one of Christianity's most famous prayers, so famous that even you and I, not raised in religious homes,
know it by heart.
We knew it by heart, and it contains a word that nobody actually knows what it means, and nobody, scholars can't even agree on it.
Very interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, all right, whatever you say.
Right.
So then we move on from there to Jesus teaching about fasting, the right way to fast.
You don't eat.
Right.
But
there was a thing that said, just oil your fucking beard, right?
Right.
And you were like, oil your beard? What? And so I kind of looked into that a little bit just to make sure we had a good understanding. And I was right on that one. Olive oil functioned partly like moisturizer, hair product, perfume, and hygiene. They used it to clean their body.
Got it.
Not just like spiritually cleanse, but like, to actually, you know...
It was the shampoo of ancient times.
Well, yeah. And also, like, it kept away bugs and stuff like that because, you know, your skin is oily when you have that on.
Right.
So this was a big deal. Like, remember we talked in the last episode about the importance of salt to that culture during the time?
Yeah.
In this episode, we'll talk a little bit about the importance of oil, like... olive oil, not just gasoline oil
or
crude oil.
Right. I mean, olive oil was very,
very important. Yeah, very important.
In that region, in that time, you know.
Mm-hmm. In the dry climate of the ancient Near East, oiling your hair, your beard, your skin was part of everyday grooming. So Jesus is basically saying at that time, look normal. Don't make fasting into theater.
Just do your normal shit.
Just do your normal shit.
Right.
Yeah. Like, Don't be weird.
Right.
Like he's saying all the time, don't be an asshole. Don't be a dick. Don't be weird. So we've got don't be an asshole. Now we've got don't be weird.
Yeah.
Okay. So then we move on to the place of material things, a warning against covetousness. And we get the treasures in heaven and the light of the body. And the choice between two treasures and the choice between two visions.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember any of that.
I mean, I remember us talking about like how Elon and Bezos are going to be fucked.
Yeah, for sure.
if it were to be true that, you know, mm-hmm. God were real or something.
Oh, yeah, 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 totally. Which,
again,
not.
It's not.
This is, after all, an atheist podcast.
Right, yeah. So.
But just to read verses 22 and 23, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Right. Remember, we were like, that sounds so fucking ableist.
Yeah.
Like, fuck you if you're blind.
If you got cataracts, you're fucked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But then I looked into it and I was like, oh, yeah. Do you remember when we did this whole episode about the evil eye? It was one of our special offshoot episodes.
Maybe vaguely, but it seems like it was a long time ago.
It wasn't that long ago. It was within the last 2 years for sure.
Okay.
For sure. It wasn't that long ago.
Got it.
And in Jewish idioms, a good eye often means generosity, sincerity, and moral clarity. So a healthy eye is going to be an empathetic, undivided outlook.
Okay.
Okay.
So it has more to do with actions than with actual physical.
Not just actions, but your spiritual being.
Right.
Like the way you are thinking about it.
Sure.
So if your eyes are healthy, means if your eyes are generous, if your outlook is generous.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
An evil eye meant greed, envy, stinginess, or selfishness. So a bad eye is basically corrupted values. So where it says if your eyes are unhealthy, it's basically saying if you are a stingy son of a bitch.
It's shorthand for the time or whatever. Yeah. They used it as meaning these other things, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
People genuinely believe that envy or greed could radiate harmful power through the eyes. And the reason is because... I mean, you're laughing, but I'm totally remembering back to our episode that we did over evil eye.
No, you're misinterpreting why I'm laughing. I'm laughing because as soon as you said that, the first thing that came to my mind is, oh, Superman channeled all of his evil and greed through his eyes. That's how he did it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's where we get Homelander in The Boys.
Well, yeah, he's got too much to even channel through his eyes. So,
yeah,
you know, he's,
yeah. Oof.
That guy.
That show was so off the hook that we haven't watched the last two seasons, and
I really want to.
Yeah. I really want to. But
I feel like we ought to watch one tonight. After we're done with the show.
I'm not for it. No.
No.
No. Mm. We're still working through Picard.
I thought I'd try that one out.
No, we're working through Star Trek Picard. Maybe at the end we're on season two of Star Trek Picard. After season two, maybe we'll take a break from Star Trek. And we'll watch some of The Boys.
Okay.
But I don't know. I mean, that show is so fucking gruesome.
It really is.
It's grotesque and gruesome.
And fantastic,
but it is not for the faint of heart.
No, no.
And I am faint of heart, so.
Right.
I have both missed the characters and the storyline and the struggle, but I have not missed.
And it could definitely trigger some trauma.
Warning to anybody
that might think about watching this because of our review of it.
I mean, we were telling Kid is 21, just to clarify, like, I'm not telling my child,
right?
You know, you should totally watch this, like my 6-year-old. We were telling our 21-year-old, actually, you'd probably like this show a lot because Kid has a very dark, twisted sense of humor.
Yeah.
And I was explaining how Hugh got his origin story, how he got pulled into the world of the supers,
right?
You know, and you know, his girlfriend.
Yeah, that was pretty terrible. That was a terrible start to a series. I was like, what the fuck?
It was immediate, and it only got worse from there.
Yeah,
and Kip was looking at me with eyes just like. Their eyebrows were on top of their head, and they were like, what the fuck is wrong with you that you think I would like this, and why do you like this? And, like, you can't explain the show to somebody else and sound sane.
It's true.
Because how do you like that?
It sounds absolutely terrible.
How could you possibly like that?
Right. It's so bad, we're not going to even describe what happened because it's really bad.
It's so bad.
Yeah.
Train ran through her. Oh, okay. Anyway, listen. So we're talking about eyes.
Okay? Yeah, back to eyes.
Your eye is like your desires, okay? Mm-hmm. Because the eyes are like into your soul, right? Sure. Your desires shape your life, because what you focus on shapes your emotional world. Where your treasure is, your heart follows. And this idiom appears elsewhere in ancient Jewish literature, as ancient people often treated the eye as the gateway of desire, the gateway to the soul, intention, perception, moral orientation.
I think there is some truth behind that as to like what you choose to focus on, what you choose to.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have any, like the eye itself is not like this magical entity in your body, you know, but
no.
it does translate okay into a secular viewpoint. Like it's mm-hmm. not.
I mean, there's a reason why we say, look me straight in the eye
right.
and tell me the truth.
Yeah, because you can glean something from how someone reacts or what someone
generally
says.
Generally speaking.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless they're, you know, sociopaths or something.
Right,
so.
Right. Or if you're really bad at reading people.
Right, yeah, there's that too.
But, I mean, some people are actors.
Sure. And no, and that's just it. There's ways around it, even if you're not a sociopath. Like, I mean,
yeah.
So it's not perfect, but it is something that we as humans have learned. Right. We learn that we can kind of gauge another human being by the way they're reacting to us, by the way they're looking at us, mm-hmm. by the way they're, you know, interacting and all that. So,
I mean, that's why that whole episode about the evil eye, I can't believe you don't remember it.
I vaguely remember covering it.
But. Like there were times when if somebody glared at your baby, it was thought that they gave the baby the evil eye. And so
I do remember that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so like they had to have little charms or they had to like draw little designs on
right.
their crib to ward off the evil eye.
Yeah.
Because intentions matter.
Sure.
And you can tell somebody's intention supposedly by what's in their eye. And so when Jesus discusses the eye as a lamp or light or darkness,
yeah.
ancient listeners heard layers that modern readers might miss. So when he's like, you know, if your eyes are healthy, blah, blah, blah. And like, what did we hear? We're like, oh, so if you're blind, you're fucked. Got
right.
it.
Yeah.
Like ableist. And he and like, yes, but no, because
sure.
Jesus is like, dude, I'm not fucking talking about your actual goddamn eyes, okay?
Right.
And I'm like, oh, my bad. Maybe you should be more clear because you are the Son of God.
Right, yeah.
Like, how could I know? Okay, the next bit we get to, this is so interesting. Do you remember the whole you can't serve two masters?
Yes.
Okay, so our translation did not use the word God versus Mammon.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Nor did it use Mormammu. Mormammu, I've come to negotiate. Okay, I'm so sorry. That's a Doctor Strange reference
yes.
because I do love me some Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
But that's not what we're here to talk about.
Right.
Okay. The two masters are God and Mammon. And so when I saw this in my notes, because all the other translations are, you cannot serve God and Mammon. And I was like, I'm sorry, excuse me, record scratch, what's a Mammon?
Yeah, what's a Mammon?
Yeah. Most of them say you can't serve like God and money, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And so, and there is a tie there.
Okay. All right.
Mammon is not exactly a demon name in the text originally. It's an Aramaic word meaning wealth, property, material resources, and possessions.
Okay.
And Jesus probably originally spoke this line in Aramaic, and then the gospel writers rendered it into Greek while preserving that particular Semitic word.
Oh.
And so Mammon is not actually a proper noun. It's a descriptive noun.
Ah.
It's not okay. a name. It's a... Like, it's a thing.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And that thing is greediness and money.
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
Which eventually Christians turned into a demon.
Of course. Why, a money demon. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
At first, it just meant wealth viewed as something to be trusted in.
Okay.
And Mammon has a much broader emotional sense than the word money carries. And that's why they didn't use the word for money. They
Got
didn't
it.
Just say
it meant much more.
Yeah.
It encompassed much more.
It wasn't just money, it was wealth. And it wasn't just wealth, it was wealth as power, as security,
as greed,
as an object of devotion,
right.
greed. Yeah.
Sure.
the economic system as your master.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was whole system.
Again, very interesting.
Very relevant to me, today.
Capitalism does not equate well with Christianity.
Yeah.
You know, like it doesn't.
Matthew has something to say about capitalism, y'all.
I'm sure.
I can't speak for the whole fucking Gospels. I can't speak for the whole New Testament. I can say that Matthew up through chapter 7 has something to fucking say about capitalism.
Right, right.
And he is not pleased. Y'all doing this wrong. Okay? It's closer to the negative connotation of materialism or wealth as a ruling force.
Okay.
And many translators feel that the word money loses its punch. And I will say, that's the way we read it. And yeah, it definitely did not carry the same punch.
Right, right.
Like, yeah. Mammon definitely, whether demon or, you know, wealth as a whole system.
Right.
Like, that's definitely different from just, like, don't worship money.
Yeah, yeah.
In later Christian tradition, especially medieval literature, Mammon became personified as a demon, the prince of greed, and the entire embodiment of avarice.
Okay.
So just think of like the Monopoly man walking around with like dollar signs in his eyeballs.
Yeah.
And that's Mammon.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
You see this especially in medieval sermons, morality plays, which would have been from that same time period, and then later art and literature. So by the time John Milton wrote Paradise Lost, Mammon is basically a full infernal character associated with greed and earthly wealth.
Okay.
Totally not biblical, though.
Right.
Like, no, that's not a demon, y'all.
Yeah.
Okay. That's very much a later development and not what Matthew originally meant.
Or Jesus.
Right. Exactly. Well, I keep saying Matthew because he's the one, he or his acolytes or his followers or whatever, his crowd, he's the one that wrote this shit.
Or stapled it together.
Yeah.
Like, the truth is we don't fucking know.
Well, whether Jesus said it or not, Matthew is the one that wrote it down. And or by exactly. Matthew, I mean Matthew, et cetera.
Sure.
Okay.
Right.
So that's why I say Matthew has some things to say. And Matthew that's not what Matthew meant.
But I feel like because it's in the red print and Jesus said it, mm-hmm. that it strikes a stronger chord if you say Jesus.
I don't want to say that, though, because I know that there's different people that are like, yeah, but Jesus also said, and we're going to get to those, and they're going to undo what this guy said that Jesus said.
Well, no, that's Paul. That mm-hmm. says some of those things.
Yeah, but a different part of the New Testament, Matthew's like, Jesus said this. And then we're going to get to a place where Paul's like, yeah, but Jesus also said this.
Well, and we can argue those in due time.
Right, but knowing that that's coming, that's why I'm like, according to Matthew.
Sure. Again, first book of the New Testament.
Yeah.
This is how it opens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you put your strongest stuff up front, right?
Like, yeah.
You got to get that good opener.
Sure.
So I'm just...
Well, the reason, I mean, we covered this too. The reason that Matthew came first, even though he wrote his gospel after Mark wrote his, and Matthew got a lot of his shit from Mark.
Again, probably not Mark and Matthew.
But. Right. But the book of Matthew got a lot of its material from the book of Mark,
right.
which came first. They put Matthew first because he was speaking more to a Jewish audience and related more to Judaism.
Sure.
So, and he was a tax collector.
Oh, I didn't know he was a
tax collector. You did know that because...
Okay, I did know that.
You did know that.
I don't know it now.
Specifically,
I know it now, but I didn't know it a second ago.
Well, we discussed it in the intro to Who the Fuck a Matthew, but right. It didn't stick because didn't stick. Who cares? And then we talked about, remember how tax collectors are hated? And I should have said at the time, and Matthew was one, so he would know.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that actually, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So moving on, we're almost done with chapter 6. We move to the final verses of the chapter where he talks about the place of material things and being having anxiety over that.
Okay.
And we were like, whether you worry or have concern. Do you remember that? And it was like, Well, I mean, if you're worrying and, you know, you have your blood pressure go up and you go to the doctor to have that checked, then it was good that you worried about it,
yes, right? Yes, right.
So
right.
Worry can be helpful.
Yeah.
And then I clarified, I think that that would fall more under the realm of concern and being positive and taking care of something,
sure,
than needless worry, which the word that came up a lot was anxiety, okay, in my notes. And that's what Jesus was referring to.
Okay.
Needless anxiety and panic and running around. Not just like, hey, I'm really concerned about this, so I'm going to make a plan to take care of it.
Okay. All right.
Okay. He's not talking about frivolousness. Like, he wants you to take care of your shit.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anxiety as a condition was treated as spiritually corrosive. So the chapter repeatedly says, do not worry. And the Greek word for worry here has the sense of being divided, mentally pulled apart in multiple directions, and being consumed by so many different cares.
It's interesting to me because I feel like what happened in ancient times is that mental diseases got categorized as spiritual wrongness,
mm-hmm,
right? Like these, yeah, are things that are able to be treated now and diagnosed and, mm-hmm, and made better, generally speaking, if someone cares to do so.
Yep.
And, but because there was no way to do that back then, these things were viewed as a very, as a stigma, like as something bad and wrong with somebody.
Right.
And therefore spiritually bad or wrong as well.
Yeah.
Which leads to, in my opinion, kind of the whole stigma of mental health. Like it's a stigma even back in ancient times.
It's right? always been a stigma.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which really sucks for women who are more likely to have their hormones out of whack and therefore more likely to be inclined.
Right.
To have that
to having
anxiety.
Mental issues. Right.
Yeah. 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 So once again, women always suffer. But to get back to this, the issue is not merely concern or planning, like I said.
Yeah.
It's instead closer to chronic fragmentation of attention. And this is remarkably compatible with, as you said, modern psychology.
Yeah.
This really hit home for me because some of the terminology that came up in my notes was rumination, anxiety spirals, attention capture, and stress fixation.
Sure.
Those are all words that people who are neurodivergent, particularly those suffering from ADHD and or OCD,
yeah,
will have those.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, shit. I'd be in all kinds. Like, one of the things that I'm working with my OCD therapist on is rumination in particular.
Right.
I have a really bad struggle with that.
Yeah.
And so I would have been all kinds of fucked.
Right.
And Jesus, it would have been like, stop. I'm like, dude, I'm taking medication for it and I am working with a therapist.
I wonder what Jesus would have thought of medication.
That's actually a modern day argument.
Really?
That, yeah. My mom has spoken to various pastors as she has church hopped.
Yeah.
To get their opinion on whether or not she is allowed,
oof,
by their church,
wow,
to take medication.
That's nuts.
That's why she checks with the pastor, because she's like, I'm taking my medication.
Right.
Yeah. I need a church where Jesus says it's cool.
That is so. But that alone, that is so fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
You have to church shop to find a church that is, yeah, okay with you helping your own, with helping
your
yourself.
Own medical issues.
Right.
Yeah.
That's insane.
And that's why the church,
sorry,
needs to get out of relationships that should exist only between you and your doctor.
I just realized I said insane to describe.
Oh.
That's
yeah.
Unbelievable. That's
mm-hmm,
not good.
Yeah, you shouldn't have said that.
No, I know.
Insane.
I didn't. I'm catching good myself catch. Insane. I apologize. And
good catch,
I,
husband.
I have to rein myself in sometimes. I'm sure I say it all the times and forget, but
we do use incorrect language, and we are fallible to that, and we do try to catch ourselves because we do want to be inclusive and we never want to be harmful,
right,
and say things that were at one point acceptable by society, not acceptable by
today's standards.
Today's standards.
Right.
Right. And I know somebody always will push back and say, well, it was never acceptable. And I'm like, I don't think that word means what you think it means.
Sure.
The fact that people were walking around fucking saying it means that it was acceptable by society as a whole.
Right.
They accepted it.
Yeah.
That's why they did it. Not, was it good that they did that? No.
Right.
Obviously, that's why the language changed.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, we try to be good and we try to call ourselves out. So good job, husband.
Yeah, thanks.
Good job on sucking and then owning it.
I don't. Yeah. Sure.
Anyway, moving on.
Uh-huh.
He goes a lot into anxiety.
Okay.
And anxiety spirals. And he's like, don't.
Right.
And then from there, he goes into having it was the whole thing with the birds of the air. Do you remember that? He was talking about the birds.
No.
Okay. So it was an argument for pursuing earth. Okay, hold on. Because the kingdom of God is so greatly superior to earthly pursuits, it deserves our attention. Examples and arguments against worry, such as consider the birds of the air, who they don't hoard.
Yeah. And God
they
just go for around them and
yeah.
blah blah blah.
They
blah, blah.
They just go about their business
right,
and
right.
they don't store up.
Yeah.
And then it was like the flowers in the fields. They're beautiful and yet even Solomon never dressed so nice.
Right.
And he was human and I like that guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the point is birds do not obsessively hoard or control the future, yet life somehow goes on.
Control the future?
The birds don't control the future.
Okay.
They don't do anything to control their
right.
future.
Okay.
They just live from moment to moment.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
They just pull the worm out the ground because they got there early.
Yeah.
Everybody knows the early bird gets the fucking
That's
worm
right.
or whatever.
That's right.
So Jesus is arguing against anxiety-driven obsessions with food, clothing, survival, status, and material security.
Sure.
He's like, y'all just need to fucking chillax.
Right.
You ain't got to be wearing Gap all the time.
All you need is God and, you know, to survive.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. So this section connects to the larger theme, which is to stop organizing your entire life around acquisition and anxiety. And then the rest of the chapter mentions flowers being more beautifully dressed than Solomon, which I already said.
Yeah.
And then the point there being, imagine the richest king imaginable versus temporary wildflowers. Nature effortlessly exceeds human status displays.
Yeah.
Like peacocks are so gorgeous.
Right. Just something that crossed my mind that, so, I mean, there's a lot of theories that Jesus was just a prophet in the time and whatever and preaching his thing and doing his stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it occurs to me that, you know, we said this even about Moses, and we definitely say it about preachers and pastors today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that they want to make their money. They want to get their fame. They want to get their, mm-hmm. like, they've got to make a name for themselves, right? They've got to stand out. Well, if you can talk a rich person into giving up their wealth to God,
mm-hmm.
who's that go to?
Right.
I'm just, you know.
The church.
I'm just, right. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily what Jesus was out for, but there is a lot of talk in different aspects about how you should not value money as much, and then you should give it to God. God should manage that money. Like,
they're trying
to get rich people to get up off their money, basically. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's two different things, because on the one hand, it's don't go out there collecting it,
yeah.
and then don't hold on to it.
Right.
And that's two separate things.
Sure.
And he's saying, don't live your life always trying to collect it and get it.
Yeah.
And then once you have it, or say you were born into it, don't be hoarding it and sitting up on it.
What's that hoarding part that I'm like, oh, so you think it could be better spent over here, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, look, again, I'm not saying Jesus specifically was going for that angle, but there are a lot of people that take that angle and use that for their own purposes.
Sure. But I am going to point out something that I pointed out in the previous episode, which is that this was very political.
Yeah.
Let us not forget that this was happening during upheaval.
Right.
And
occupation.
And so the birds and lilies are very anti-empire imagery.
Mm.
Okay.
Okay.
Jesus is speaking to people under Roman occupation, heavy taxation, debt systems, subsistence economics.
Got it.
So people just trying to scrape by, people just trying to make it.
Right.
From one day to the next.
Sure.
So him saying don't devote your life to survival anxiety, it lands differently when it's spoken to, when you understand that it's spoken to peasants living near economic collapse.
Right.
He's saying
people are just trying to survive and they do have anxiety over it.
Yes. And so that makes it like a little more, oh.
Right.
Like I thought he was speaking to the rich people telling them to stop hoarding wealth. And maybe he is, but he's more than that speaking
to
poor people. Yeah, he's being Fox News and saying, don't believe your lying eyes.
Right.
The gas prices aren't that bad. Stop fixating on it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
God will provide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So some scholars read this almost as resistance to imperial economic pressure and a rejection of elite wealth culture. But I think that's iffy.
I mean, we're talking about things so long ago that even taking into account what was happening at the time, it's hard to say what the speech was actually about.
Yeah.
I
think it would depend on which people were more likely to be in his crowd. And we can't know that.
Right. And moreover, this speech was taken from multiple speeches probably, mm-hmm. and there might have been multiple audiences.
Right.
So we don't know how this was pieced together, how it was said in the first place.
Right.
There's so much lost with regard to context,
mm-hmm.
that I don't think we could ever fully put it together.
It is worth entertaining the notion, however, that he might have been a political rebel and standing up for the poor.
Sure.
And, you know, trying to get them to just make it through.
Yeah.
It is worth entertaining the notion. That's not beyond the realm of possibility.
Right.
Some scholars think that this chapter in particular reflects apocalyptic expectations. One interpretation is that Jesus believed God's kingdom was arriving very soon, which, I mean, that makes sense. Remember, they were expecting the Messiah any second now.
Yeah, no, right? it was a rampant idea mm-hmm. at that point in history.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Which is why Jesus came from, like, the whole thing culminated in producing what it produced.
So. Exactly. So that means don't store up treasure, don't hoard, becomes a lot more understandable. Why would you build long-term wealth systems if the current world order is temporary?
Right.
And that changes the tone a little bit too.
Sure.
Instead of timeless self-help wisdom, some sayings become advice for people expecting imminent cosmic change like any second now.
Right.
That's it's really interesting to
more me. In line with the fucking Heaven's Gate
cult
that did the Kool-Aid shit.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, you know, they gave everything away and they went and
did their thing.
Did their thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, like they were convinced. They were convinced.
Yep.
And this is similar, just with a slightly longer time frame than, you know, after you drink the glass.
Yeah.
So.
Ooh. 2,000 years.
Yeah. Right.
And counting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was chapter 6. Then we move into chapter 7. And this one goes a lot faster.
Okay.
Because it wraps it up.
Okay.
Okay. So you might notice in this one that Matthew fucking loves his paired contrast. We get the wise versus the foolish, the sheep versus the wolves, the true versus the false prophets, the good tree versus the bad tree,
right.
The rock versus the sand, the narrow gate
versus the wide gate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Matthew chapter 7 becomes a cascade of moral binary choices. And that's what's known in literary terms as a mirism.
Okay.
M-E-R-I-S-M. Mir. That's a literary device where two extremes imply a totality. So when we have a good tree versus a bad tree, that means that's all the possible moral outcomes.
Right.
It's either or, not nor.
Which I hate. Like, I hate
it simplifies
black
it.
And white. I hate right and wrong.
Totally.
That's just not how the world operates.
Yeah. The wide gate versus the narrow gate means that's all life directions. It's two things are used in opposition to each other to represent the whole.
Right.
And it does flatten it, but it also is really a simple tool for representation of larger message.
From putting across an idea, it's mm-hmm. it's very easy to use those types of symbols.
Yeah.
But it's not good and correct.
Yeah, because what happens is ancient Jewish teaching loved this binary structure.
Yeah.
Matthew especially liked the dramatic either-or categories like saved or destroyed, true or false, wise or foolish.
Right.
And that, unfortunately, is what happens is we get the all possible moral outcomes thing.
Yeah.
And when those are your only options, there's no nuance. There's no gray area. There's no, but what's the story behind it?
Right. I mean, life is really more like the coffee wall when you go into the grocery store and you can't possibly make a fucking decision because there's 5 billion goddamn coffees to choose from. And you're like, Jesus, this is
too many.
This is ridiculous.
That takes me into a spiral all its own, literally. And it was coffee that was my first indication.
Well, there's literal. I mean, it's become almost an entire aisle in the goddamn the grocery stores these days.
Well,
like it's almost an entire fucking aisle.
Being forced to, my parents gave me money and sent me to the store to pick up some coffee. And this was when I was a teenager. And we were overseas, so it was a commissary shelf, which means there weren't a lot of choices, but there was more than three.
Right.
And that was too many.
Yeah.
And I froze and I panicked and I cried because what if I chose the wrong one? And so what you just said there, like, that hits
a little bit.
Yeah. That hits a little too close to home.
Sure.
Yeah. So this makes the gospel rhetorically powerful when you're doing either or. But it also contributes to that whole black and white thinking that Christianity is often criticized for.
Right, right.
And my dad specifically has said, no, everything is black and white.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It's in the Bible as black and white. Everything Jesus says is black and white.
Such a terrible way to view the world.
It's such a bad take.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but you met me. You know that there is nuance. Yeah.
There's literal nuance in your own life.
Yeah,
like you could we could reference it in one conversation we're having with you where there's nuance.
Yeah,
like that is not something that is up for debate. It is the way life works,
nuance
the way conversations
exists.
And relationships work.
Yeah,
it's
black and white is for babies.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's so childish.
Yeah,
yeah. And again, for getting an idea across, I'm okay with it as long as it's followed up with a deeper conversation, maybe.
Something that falls under that is zero tolerance policies.
Right.
And I don't care what it applies to.
I fucking hate
them. I fucking hate them. They're childish.
They are.
They don't take nuance into account and they are for babies.
Yeah. Like when we were younger, we couldn't go to the bathroom in school because you were not allowed to use, at least in school when I was going, maybe it changed a little bit once I got to high school, but like there was a policy in place. No one was allowed to go leave the classroom to use the restroom.
Yeah, my mom and dad, my parents sucked in so many different ways, and I could enumerate them. But one of the ways that they did not suck was on the bathroom tolerance policy. We had permission. You always ask permission.
Right.
You always be respectful. And you respectfully say, but I am going though.
Right, right.
Because if you have to pee or change your tampon or shit or barf or any number of human things, that doesn't always work on a clock and it's nobody's business but you, your body, and the toilet.
Right, right.
And I don't understand. And I never understood the thing where teachers say, 3 minutes between classes to get from your one classroom to the locker to the other classroom. That's plenty of time. And I'm like,
but it's actually not.
It's not.
Yeah.
Like, it's not. And then you add in bathroom and forget it.
Right.
And I'm sorry, but
At some point, I'm going to have to stop by my locker or use the bathroom, possibly even both during one of these times, if not during class.
Yeah.
Like, these things are just things that happen.
Yeah.
You can't dictate to me when I'm going to be needing to do those things.
Yeah.
I mean, you can structure, mm-hmm. but the structure has to allow for those gray areas.
Yeah.
The structure cannot be rigid.
Look, are kids going to take advantage of it? Sure as fuck they will.
Right.
And you need to understand that and work around it, not against it.
Right.
And I'm sorry, but zero tolerance means that you don't have to pay attention and try. You can just be like, it's the whole, I don't know who was talking. I don't care who was talking. It was probably that one troublemaker who's always talking. But I'm going to punish the whole goddamn class because I'm lazy and I can't be fucking bothered. And I have a zero tolerance policy.
Look, I've got complaints. I've got complaints about college, but in general, it was one of the most amazing things ever.
Liberating.
Being allowed to do whatever the fuck you wanted.
To be an adult and to be responsible for your own body and to not have to ask permission. Like, it got to the point in high school where I wouldn't even ask, may I use the restroom? I would literally say, may I please go change my tampon? Even if all I had to do was go pee. Because I wanted a teacher to tell me, no, you may not go change your tampon. You should have timed it better.
Right.
And for me to then say, I'm sorry, sir, did you want to have a conversation about tampon timing? Is that really what we're doing here? Because I'm not doing it. Because right. I'm a bitch is why.
Sure.
I'm a fucking bitch. All right. Anyways, so then we move on to judgment and discernment. And verses 3-5, I'm going to read.
Okay.
Okay. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye?
And I said, because you can't see your own fucking eye.
And I was like, why you got a plank in your eye?
Right,
that's
yeah.
so ridiculous. How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye.
Mm.
So take care of yourself before you worry about others.
I mean, right? You know, yeah.
Right. But, I don't know. That always bothered me, because I'm like, why do you have a plank in your eye? That's so fucking stupid. I don't understand. And, like, I'm dumb, because that was, like, the whole point. It was humor.
Right.
But I didn't understand, because Jesus is so serious.
Well, like, he's serious insofar as we've been present. Like, we don't know. Maybe Jesus was a goddamn comedian.
Well, apparently, throughout the whole fucking New Testament, he's a comedian. From what I've read, he's actually kind of a funny guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so he told a lot of, like, comparison jokes and stuff. And I know there's a place that we're going to meet where he's pretty sarcastic.
Really?
And he's like, okay. And I can't wait for it. But here, he's using humor. And it's easy to miss the metaphor because it's become so familiar over the centuries.
Sure.
But it's the contrast between the two that makes this so intentionally absurd. Because we've got a speck, a tiny bit of dust or a straw or whatever, like a piece of sand, versus a plank, which is a beam used in construction, like a roof beam or timber. So he's like comparing two ridiculous things, like a fly versus an elephant. He's basically saying, why are you worrying about the fly when you got a fucking elephant sitting on you, dumbass?
Right, right.
And like, I didn't get it.
Can you imagine a church service or a church in general that just was light, didn't take itself seriously,
right?
Played into the humor aspects, like, you know, like, it was like, ah, oh, yeah, you know, like, I feel like that would be the way to go, mm-hmm. right? Like, if you're going to really try to build a...
make it fun.
Make it fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you mean like with any class that you're teaching ever, or with any speech that you're delivering ever?
Right. I mean, how else are you going to get through the bears attacking the children? You know, you got to bring some humor into that
shit,
right?
It's so true. It's so true. So Jesus was basically doing exaggerated visual comedy. He was like doing a stand-up routine.
Yeah.
And so he's like, basically imagine someone carefully criticizing a tiny eyelash in another person's eye. Well, you've got a fucking telephone pole sticking out of your face.
Right.
Like,
right.
That was what he was trying to say.
Yeah.
And the image is ridiculous on purpose.
Sure.
Which, again, I was like, that's stupid. And Jesus is like going, uh-huh. So The metaphor works because eyes were associated with perception, moral insight, and spiritual understanding. So right. that's why he was using the eyes specifically.
Right.
So the irony is that the person with the largest impairment thinks that they see the most clearly and that they're the most good.
Sure.
Which that's yeah, funnier that's funny. In yeah. retrospect,
right.
you know?
Right.
Jesus often teaches with deliberately impossible or grotesque images, as I mentioned, and we're going to see some more of that when he's going to reference a camel going through the eye of a needle.
Right.
And like I've heard that before.
That's a famous one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Swallowing a camel after straining a gnat.
I've never heard that one.
No, me neither. I'm excited for that one. Yeah. Cutting off your hand if it causes you to sin.
Okay.
Like, apparently that was supposed to be funny.
I thought we already covered that one.
We did.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And that was supposed to be funny.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, because I mean, he's saying, like, remember what I said? Oh, it wasn't me that was looking. It was my eye. So I'll just cut my eye out.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And he's basically saying, it wasn't your fucking eye and you know it.
Right.
And it wasn't your hand, but if it was, okay, cut your hand off then.
Sure.
And like, we didn't see the humor because we were just like, oh, how dare.
Right.
So, but yeah, apparently like Jesus is real funny.
I like that. I like that image.
Cool.
I'd have a beer with him. I like that image.
Yeah. Yeah. So the point is not realism, it's memorability. And this is one of the clearest examples of ancient comedic exaggeration in early literature.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I really like that.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. So Jesus is not always serene and solemn in the text. Sometimes he's vividly sarcastic.
Nice.
Yeah. And that's cool.
That didn't come through in any, you know,
no.
church thing I've ever been through.
No, that he's kind of a hoopy food.
Right. Yeah. No, I like that image.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Buddy Jesus is becoming a more solid figure in my mind as we read Matthew, honestly. So then we get like dogs and pearls before swine. Do you remember all that? And you were like, I've never heard of don't throw pearls before swine.
Right, yeah.
And I'm still like, I can't believe you've never heard that.
Sorry.
There's literally a Sunday comic that's been out for over a decade called Pearls Before Swine. And it's based on this.
I must have been reading Calvin and Hobbes. I don't know.
Probably. I mean, I was too. So verse 6 reads, do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces, even though you were the one that taught them.
Right.
You know, they'll bite the hand that feeds, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So the common interpretation is don't waste valuable truths on people determined to reject or mock them.
That would be us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't waste your valuable truths on us.
This whole Bible thing is wasted on us.
It sure is.
They shouldn't have tossed
them. We are determined to reject and mock them. That is a fact. But I mean,
I think we're being fair.
I think we're being
fair. For the most, we try to be fair.
Look, Jesus is kind of cool, you guys.
So far.
I mean,
like, there's some things I've got issue with.
But I feel like, according to what I've read, that he would be willing to sit down and discuss them.
Right. Now, do I think he's the Son of God? Fuck.
Oh, absolutely.
Not even a fucking chance.
No.
But, like, I like to look at this in some regards as just a piece of literature from the past, you know? And with that in mind, comparatively speaking to what we read in the Old Testament, this ain't that bad,
y'all. Women are still chattel.
Right.
Slavery is still allowed.
I did say comparatively speaking.
Yes. Comparatively speaking. Yeah. So the pearls in this little statement are meant to symbolize wisdom, sacred teachings, truth, and spiritual insight.
Okay.
And the swine symbolize those who don't recognize value, people who are hostile to the message, people incapable of appreciating wisdom, and those who become angry when they can't digest new or different ideas.
Got it.
In Jewish culture of the time, pigs were unclean animals, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Yep.
And wild dogs were associated with scavengers. They were not pets.
Okay.
Like, man's best friend was not a thing.
Right, yeah.
So both animals represented impurity or even hostility.
Okay.
And this sounds really harsh to modern ears, but Jesus often used culturally loaded animal imagery.
Sure.
Remember, like last time I told you about the Roman horses, he would reference them a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Pearls, on the other hand, were among the most valuable portable luxury items in the Roman world.
Hmm.
The economic absurdity is part of the rhetorical punch that either or, you've got both extremes there again.
Right, right.
Then he gives more instructions for prayer, ask, seek, knock, that thing. Right. And we were like, whatever. I kind of asked when I was a kid. I wouldn't have minded.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Fuck you for that. Fuck you for blaming me for your inability. Like, no. I knocked. Whatever.
Well, people would say we didn't knock hard enough.
Oh, that's
we didn't pray hard. We didn't actually mean it.
Well, I wouldn't have known how because I was a fucking child.
Right.
And that's not my fault.
Yeah.
So fuck off.
I mean, you could give every child a chance. That could be a thing.
Yeah.
Or like you could give every child that insight and say, and then they could make their decision from there.
Right.
Which that insight was never given to
Look,
me.
Don't blame me for not believing in your imaginary bullshit.
Right.
That's what I don't like.
I'm
not the problem here.
I think one of the weirdest things that ever occurred to me when I was younger, right, was that there are people in the world that have never even heard of Jesus.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, what? So how does that work?
Yeah.
How does the whole Jesus and God thing work if they've never had a chance to even hear about him?
I literally asked my one of my best friends in high school about that, and she said she would have to ask her pastor, and I was like, let me know what he says. And I was like actually very seriously concerned.
Yeah.
I wanted to know the fucking answer.
Right, yeah. If what you're saying is true, this is a problem, yo.
And I cried because I was like, that's not fair.
Right.
Like, okay, fine. Me, I've heard about it. I don't believe or I don't feel or I don't whatever. I guess I'm going to hell. That's fine. But those people don't even know. And like, I was arguing with her and I was crying because I was like, that's not fair.
Right.
That's literally not fair.
Yeah.
They just, oh, well, boom, you go to hell. Like, what? That is not an okay system. I'm not for that.
That's a bad.
Again, can we get some nuance up in here, please?
Right, yeah.
All right. So then we get Jesus showing how men should deal with each other. Okay.
Okay.
Ethical teaching regarding our treatment of others, the golden rule.
Yeah.
Verse 12. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. And this was so interesting. Studying this was so interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even looking up, like, let's talk about the golden rule. I have questions about it. I just happened to stumble across this. And so I'm just so glad because this is so interesting.
Yeah.
The golden rule itself was not unique at that time. But what was unique about it was that Jesus phrased it positively. Versions of the golden rule already existed earlier in Judaism, Greece, Persia, China, India. It was a thing.
Yeah.
But the interesting distinction is that many older versions are negative. Don't harm other people. Whereas Jesus frames it positively. Actively do good.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they were like saying, don't hurt other people. And he's saying, do treat people the way you want to be treated.
Yeah.
And it was the positive spin on it that made it
so much better.
So it was a new message.
Right.
And it was like,
right.
Because positive always beats negative. Although negative carries longer.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
But that's what made it revolutionary, though.
Right.
And that makes all the difference.
Definitely.
All right, and then we get into the gates, the straight gate, the narrow gate, the wide gate. I was like, what the fuck?
Right.
Okay, we've got verses 13 and 14. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't get it. And I still kind of don't get it, but maybe you can help me understand.
I interpreted it as that most people make bad choices and go through the easier path in life and choose not to go down the harder path, which leads to more, in this context, better spiritual understanding, being closer to God. They don't take the harder path that is there, but not as easy as the other one. They don't struggle to get full knowledge of their God or whatever the case may be, whatever.
It just seemed like it was trying too hard, and so I wasn't getting it.
I think that the message that he's trying to convey is that you have to work to be as spiritual as you should be. It's not just an easy road.
Okay.
The easy road is through that big wide gate right there. If you want to actually be closer to God, you have to work to get through this smaller gate.
Okay. So the road to hell is paved with good intentions kind of thing?
Sure.
Like, it's not just doing good, you gotta keep doing good or some shit like that.
You gotta work harder. You can't just do one thing and then you're through the small gate. That's gotta be your whole persona. That's gotta be everything you are. You gotta work hard to be going through the narrow gate.
Yeah, you said that.
I know. I was just reiterating.
So this idea has deep Jewish roots. Ancient Jewish wisdom literature often framed morality as two paths, life versus death, wisdom versus folly, righteousness versus wickedness.
Curvy path versus the straight path.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Matthew presents Jesus as a wisdom teacher, continuing in this tradition. So the broad path represents ease, conformity, moral laziness, following the crowd, socially normal route, you know, those things that you said.
Right.
Okay. And the narrow path represents intentional living, discipline, moral difficulty, and countercultural behavior.
And look, within the context of my own life, I agree with that. I agree with that 100%.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in a religious context.
Right.
But in the sense that
it's
taking the easy road is not always the best route.
Yeah.
Like taking the road that everybody else takes. Like you know me really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I could easily have fallen in with the right wing MAGA, mm-hmm. you know, country boy club
yep.
of people because of who I am, where I grew up and all that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
To me, though, that never made sense, and it's taken, and I'm still not perfect, but like, it's been a hard road to separate myself from the way that I was brought up and be the person that I am. You know, like it's mm-hmm. not, it would have been much easier for me to just been a good old boy that grew up in a small town, country town, and just stayed that and been that forever, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not what I felt was the right way to be. And so I'm not.
Yeah.
I guess I see the context. I see it makes sense to me because I feel like I've kind of lived that in my own way,
mm-hmm.
separate of God and religion.
I think that on a grand moral scale, that definitely holds true. But I think it also holds true on the smaller instances too, and that those are harder. Like there's the bystander effect where a crowd is standing and sees a tragedy occur and everybody else is waiting for somebody to act, somebody to call 911.
I've been guilty of not being the best person in that instance.
I mean, but that's what I'm saying. Like,
and you do better with that.
I do better with that, but only because I'm so pissed that, like, as usual, it falls to me because nobody else will do it because... Blah, 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 blah.
But I am not
a quote unquote better and more morally attuned person. What I am is a person who is autistic and has a strong sense of moral aptitude of what is right and wrong and how you're supposed to act. And I don't understand social cues.
Right.
So that doesn't mean that I'm morally better. That means that I just don't understand why is everybody standing around. That doesn't track.
No, but I will say this. By being around you for, 20 years, basically?
Mm-hmm.
This, by the way, it's our anniversary coming up,
mm-hmm.
Which I think...
We forgot to do the math.
It's like 17, 18, or 19 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly.
We always forget to do the math.
So it's somewhere in that realm because we got married twice.
Yeah.
But anyway, Anyway,
not because we broke up.
Right. But we've definitely been together for 20 years.
Yes.
Because I know when you graduated. So.
Well, that was 2006. Six. Yes, right. That's right.
So it's been 20 years.
Oh my God, we've been together for 20 years. Wow. Oh my God, that's amazing. I like that one. Let's go with that one.
Right.
Because I can remember that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, but. What I was saying is that
being around me for 20 years. Yeah, now.
You've taught me things like it's scary to be in the not part of the crowd,
mm-hmm.
and doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I've learned to adapt my sense of good to also encompass that of going against a crowd of people too.
Right.
Like it's something I've had to learn though, because it's not easy to, that is definitely not easy to do.
It's not. And I've seen you struggle with it.
Yeah.
And conversely, I have learned from you that sometimes you just need to shut the fuck up and fit in.
Right.
And you're better at that than I am.
I am. Gray areas, you know?
Right. I mean, no, I'm just saying, like, that's why there's nuance, because sometimes it is better to go against the crowd.
Sure.
And other times it's better to just, you know, if everybody around you is putting blue mud in their belly buttons, as Robert A. Heinlein was famous for saying, then that's what you do.
Right.
You know, when in Rome.
I think the real, like, the narrow gate is really trying to find, like, as it's referencing here, the narrow gate is more about trying to find that balance of when you should and when you shouldn't, and doing the right things in the moment, and learning this over a lifetime of learning, right? Learning this through trial and error, and trying to be the best person you can be, and always working towards being a better person. Like, that's how I would choose to interpret it if I were to interpret it, right?
Yeah.
So
I think that that really gets into the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is knowing that those differences exist, and wisdom is knowing when to apply which.
Right. Right.
So and we, neither one of us is very wise, but we are both. We're working on it, and we're learning, and we're learning from each other, and we're teaching each other.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways we balance each other so well.
Definitely.
So I was curious, though, but why gates? Like, why are we talking about gates?
I mean, they like gates in the Old Testament.
No, they did. They totally did. And there's a specific reason for that. Cities in the ancient world had gates controlling access, safety, trade, and even identity.
Yeah, there was, like, a fish gate in one of them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the fish gate. Right. You know, the gate is a threshold image. You choose which world you enter. And so the people would enter the city through a specific gate that they didn't necessarily have the choice. But morally, you do have the choice.
Got it.
So I was like, damn, okay. I love me a good literary symbolic
reference
and understanding.
Yeah.
Like, that makes it, okay. I like that. I like that.
For sure.
The narrow gate suggests restriction, intentional choice, and commitment.
Right.
Whereas the broad gate suggests ease, drift, and mass participation.
Sure.
The narrow gate may also critique empire and social conformity. Some modern scholars interpret the broad road politically and socially, not merely morally.
Okay.
Which, I mean, we kind of got into that a little bit, you know?
Right.
The broad road could also symbolize mainstream power structures, wealth pursuit, status seeking, participation in exploitative systems.
Right.
Like, I don't know. Buying an island, and then all of your friends eat babies, and everybody around you is eating babies, so you just think it's normal to eat babies, and then everybody just knows that those guys over there are eating babies.
Speaking of exploiting the system, did you hear about Trump's slush fund for January 6th or whatever?
Yeah,
the fucking bullshit where he's like set aside money to help people wronged by, I don't know, wokeness or something.
Yeah,
I'm not really sure what the fuck.
I can't even.
Not only did they get pardoned, but they're going to get fucking reparations for it. Fuck you.
Yeah. Like, we have an entire population of black and brown people who would like a word with you, sir.
Right.
When it comes to reparations.
Yeah.
And I'm way, way pro reparations for them.
Yeah.
Not the J6ers.
Right.
Fuck you.
That is the most. Look, there's a whole fucking slew of things that are just insane, that are not correct, that are not right.
Yeah.
But that, like, it just, it's always just one more thing. And I'm like, oh my God, this is just.
Like, you think it can't get worse. And it's like, I think we've sunk to the worst. It's just like now spreading out.
Right.
Like, we poured all of the shit. There was a bowl of shit, right? And we poured it all out on the floor. All the shit's there, but now it's spreading out.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, it's not that it gets worse so much as that it just keeps being there and being bigger and more.
Right.
Anyway, release the Trump Epstein files.
Yeah, definitely.
So Whereas the broad road symbolized Trump and his cronies and all of that bullshittery.
Sure.
The narrow road becomes resistance and humility and radical ethics, which I appreciate the use of the word radical for good.
Yeah. No, you know? I like that. Yeah.
And this interpretation resonates with Matthew's recurring suspicion toward wealth and outward religiosity. Which I'm like, all right.
Yeah.
I think Matthew's got it right. I think Matthew's a decent guy, you know?
Yeah.
So then we go on to that whole fruit tree thing.
Yeah.
And the danger of false prophets and the decision between two trees with their fruit.
Yeah.
By their fruits you shall know them. Right?
Right.
That's another famous section.
Sure.
And false prophets are compared to trees. So I was like, oh, okay, so good is good and bad is bad because right. It literally said the good fruit comes from the good tree and vice versa.
Because everything's black and white.
Yeah. Yeah. So fruit here means visible outcomes, behavior, character, and consequences. And that's why when a kid acts bad and his father's an asshole, we say the fruit don't fall far from the tree.
Right.
The apple don't fall far from the tree.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is practical ethics. Claims matter less than results. So you should think actions speak louder than words. And this also fits the chapter's anti-hypocrisy theme.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
So don't be a bad apple.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Because not only are you rotten, but you rot everything around you.
There's some truth to that.
There is. Yeah. Then we move on to Jesus showing that no man shall be saved by his mere profession of Christianity. And the decision between two claims of Jesus, one false and one true.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then we get two foundations, the parable of the wise man who built his house upon a rock versus the foolish man who built his house without a foundation on the sand. Oh, what a dum-dum.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is verses 24 through 27. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock.
Right.
But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. Mm. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the wind blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash.
Yeah.
Womp womp. Yeah. Okay, so here's the thing. Geography totally matters, okay?
Yeah.
The storm imagery and the house on the rock versus the sand metaphor, it lands a little bit differently when you have a better understanding of Judea's climate.
Okay.
Okay. Dry riverbeds were called wadis, which they still are to this day.
Right.
Yeah, we've used that term.
Yeah, yeah.
And they can look perfectly safe most of the year. And then suddenly a flood will violently storm the area and it ain't safe no more.
Right.
So don't build on the wadis.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was not just hypothetically stupid. It was an actual real regional danger.
Got it.
That was happening.
Sure.
So he was like, maybe don't do that. You know, yes, it's been dry for years, but don't.
Right. Right.
And they were like, but it's been dry for years. And he's like, but don't.
Right.
Okay. And then we go on to verses 28 and 29. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. And we were like, big deal. Okay. He had authority. Woo.
Right.
Right. Here's the thing. Matthew finished up that bit by saying that the people were amazed because Jesus taught as one having authority. The subtext of that is that the rest of the sentence goes, unlike the scribes, okay? And that subtle propaganda is like everything.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
This is Matthew like throwing shade basically
at
the other teachers of the time.
Got it.
Okay. Matthew was elevating Jesus above traditional scholarly interpreters.
Okay.
So he's like, Jesus was speaking and the people were fucking amazed at his teaching.
Got it.
You know.
Yeah.
He was teaching with authority unlike the others.
Got it. Got it.
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you, but
right.
Jesus brought
this was next level amazement. This was not
according to Matthew.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
And so he wasn't just like boosting Jesus. He was also like, these other guys, they ain't got it.
Right.
They don't got that riz.
Right.
Okay. It's not just the people like the sermon. It's his authority has surpassed the established experts.
It's interesting because they're doing a sales pitch. Mm-hmm. For Jesus.
Yes.
Which in and of itself is not a real strong indicator that he was actually considered the Son of God at the time or anything along those lines.
Yeah.
Like they're trying to pitch his case.
Yes.
So
to the rest of us.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even in the near future.
In the whoever might be reading this tomorrow, a year from now.
Yeah.
2,000 years from now.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Just so you know. Jesus was so much better.
That's actually kind of diminishes the message a little bit about Jesus.
I didn't say it was true. I'm just saying that's what Matthew was implying.
But I'm saying the fact that he's doing a sales pitch kind of diminishes the message that Jesus is the Son of God.
Yeah.
Why do you gotta do a sales pitch? He's the Son of God. If he's the Son of God, people are just gonna know he's the Son of God, right?
And I'm sorry, who are you to tell me that he surpassed the established experts?
And was he really doing miracles and shit? Because why are you doing a pitch? If he's doing miracles, then
we don't need
a sales pitch. He's just doing miracles.
But this whole thing harkens back to the whole false prophets era.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of early competition or real competition in early Judaism.
Sure.
So, like... Not just during this time period, but like remember way back.
Yeah. They talked about false prophets all the fucking time.
Yeah.
All the time.
So this is just more of that.
Right.
Talking about, unlike the false prophets, this one's the real one.
Except that the real one, they don't even know what that means yet.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
They're
He's whatever. Such a good teacher. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So, first century Judea was full of apocalyptic preachers, miracle workers, revolutionaries, wandering holy men, and messianic claimants.
Full of miracle
full workers. Full of it.
Wow.
Full.
All over the goddamn
They claimed
place.
To be, anyways. Yeah, people was walking on water all the time, you know.
Apparently.
Yeah, they was all healing the dead.
Right.
Snake oil salesmen.
Sure.
The era was religiously chaotic. It was off the fucking hook.
Interesting.
Like, you could throw a rock and not even be aiming, and you could hit a prophet. Literally. Jesus himself existed in a crowded marketplace of charismatic figures.
Huh.
So he had to stand out, and that's why his message was different.
You gotta wonder, like, because this was written after his death, right? And none of this was written during his lifetime.
Yeah.
And it was a collection of speeches and things like that, right? Did these people actually take one person?
Right.
Or was this a collection of ideas that they liked from multiple different Jesus prophets that they turned into what is now known as Jesus?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I wonder what their motivation was independently and collectively for talking about this guy after he died.
Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're about done here. Just want to say a couple more things. Matthew's Jesus is extremely concerned with authenticity. That's what the Sermon on the Mount is mostly about.
Okay.
A recurring secular interpretation of Matthew is that Jesus attacks hypocrisy more than being unreligious or irreligion.
Got it.
So he's more pissed off about hypocrisy than atheism or secularism.
Right, right.
Like, he ain't yelling at us in his sermon.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I think, well, I don't know. Yeah, hypocrisy is one of those things that Christians claim they hate, right?
But they're the most.
But, well, they're the most... There's so many different sects of Christianity, right?
Yeah.
So there's obviously going to be hypocrisy all over the fucking place because there's a million different coffee choices.
Yeah.
You know, like your coffee can't be the correct coffee when there's 5 billion other fucking choices.
Right.
You got a whole aisle of coffees. You got a whole aisle of Christians.
Well, the thing is they're all correct because everybody can pick what they like.
Sure. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
That is exactly right.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So, at least according to Matthew, the villains in the Sermon on the Mount are usually not atheists or pagans. They're religious people performing goodness socially for everybody else to see.
Sure.
And that's part of why even non-religious readers like us still find the Sermon on the Mount compelling to some degree.
Yeah.
Like, we have...
It does have a bit of a secular slash atheist slant to it in some ways.
In some ways, yeah. We could definitely get something out of it. I mean...
Yeah.
If we were to rewrite it, it wouldn't be difficult to write it with a secular slant.
Look, we went to a church for a while, right? Mm-hmm. And it was you went for reasons and then you wanted me to come because you liked the pastor and I liked the pastor. And it turns out he's atheist now. But like all in all, we really enjoyed that church because it was good people. The message was not a bad message, you know, like there was generally
he did a lot of
history,
Jewish and, teaching, which yeah. we really appreciated.
I mean, I've never believed in God. There's never been that I didn't. We even told him that we were atheists, you know, like that we didn't mm-hmm. believe in God necessarily, you know, and he was fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things in Christianity that I can get behind to some degree.
Sure.
You know, and I'm never going to lie about that and say that there's not.
The morals of it
right.
is fine.
Yeah.
Some.
But the biggest hypocrisy, like we're talking about the hypocrisy mm-hmm. here, and the hypocrisy to me is what's driving a lot of these like fundamental reverting, like the revision yes. back to like what they think Christianity used to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
instead of letting Christianity grow into what it could be.
Right.
Which...
And again, I would never grow Christianity myself, but it needs to grow in order to stay relevant. And instead, we're reverting back to something terrible.
Taking America and the rest of the world thereby with it back to the fucking dark ages.
Yeah.
And that's scary and sad.
In a very, like, there's a lot of politics behind it. There's a lot of
money.
There's a lot of purpose behind what's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, money. And it's not great. So the hypocrisy aspect of this whole speech really kind of hits home.
It does.
Right now.
Yeah.
More than ever for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of fucking hypocrisy out there.
Well, I'm like, I would like all of you Christians to spend the weekend reading the Sermon on the Mount, literally yeah. chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Matthew. I feel like Christians really need to take some time with that.
And then watch Fox News and compare those values to what's going on your fucking news channel.
Yeah.
Because it's not there.
It's
those
not.
Values are not there.
No, it's completely opposite.
Right. Examine your fucking values.
Yeah.
Examine how you're living this life with regard to what you say, Christians, mm-hmm. what you say your God is, your Jesus is, whatever that is.
I will just put it out there one more time. God was not yelling at me, my friend. God was yelling at you.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Think about that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. All right. That was our Q&A for Matthew chapters 6 and 7.
5, 6, and... Oh, yeah. This was 6 and 7.
Right.
We already did chapter 5.
Right.
So now we have done a Q&A part 1 and part 2 over the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah. And so on our next episode, we're going to be doing...
We will be getting back to reading the regular chapters of Matthew, and we are on chapter 8. Little Maddie, chapter 8. And just to kind of give you a sense of what's coming, we're going to try to do chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, and then do a Q&A over those three chapters.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, and don't forget to join us. This is going to be coming out on Sunday, so you got a couple days to do it, but you should do it right now before you forget. If you listen to this whole episode and you aren't on our Discord, what the fuck are you doing?
What are you doing with your life?
There's a link in the show notes. Go there right now.
Mm-hmm.
Click on it. Join us over there. Come to the live on Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern. Or don't if you can't. But like, you know, at least come over to the Discord. Mm-hmm. That's where all the fun is.
That's where we have fun.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
Do
it's
it.
Just good fun.
Like right now, before you forget.
Go make fun of me over there.
All right. We'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Hey, wife.
I guess that's the end.
But husband, that's just sad.
It doesn't have to be. We are on lots of social media platforms like Twitter. Our handle there is sacrilegious_D.
For D's nuts.
Oh my God. Stop doing that. Anyway, we're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest. There's a link to all of our social media sites at our website.
Ooh, we have a website?
Yeah, it's sacrilegiousdiscourse.com, where you can also find a link to our merch shop.
We have a merch shop?
Yep. We have podcast-themed clothing, mugs, notebooks, and more, as well as an atheist and science-themed products.
Wow, our fans should really go check that out right now.
Definitely. They can get in touch with us by sending an email to sacrilegiousdiscourse@gmail.com. But before they do that, we could really use some help.
Oh yeah? With what?
Well, it's not free running the podcast, and we need some financial support in order to get better equipment, which will free up time so we can concentrate on our podcast and our fans.
Okay, so what should they do?
Head over to patreon.com/sacrilegiousdiscourse and sign up as a contributor on our podcast. Supporters there receive additional bi-weekly episodes that we record just for our Patreon members for as little as $2 a month.
Also, we'd really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe on whatever platform you're using.
And Apple Podcast reviews help us out tremendously.
Like and subscribe. Leave an Apple review. Join us on Twitter. Support us on Patreon. That's a lot of instructions. Don't forget to say thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.